It's Tuesday, May 26, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams reporting from Washington. Coming up, Taiwan proposes a peace initiative for the disputed South China Sea.
One of the interesting things about the Taiwan claim is that, in fact, the main area that Taiwan occupies in the South China Sea now was originally occupied by the Japanese.
Tensions emerge in Hong Kong as the 26th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown approaches. And a U.S.-based NGO assists the victims of the recent earthquake in Nepal. It's all ahead. China's cabinet, the State Council, Tuesday issued a policy statement indicating the government's intention to project naval and air power beyond its borders. The white paper pledged the Navy will shift from offshore waters defense to open seas projection, while China will beef up its cyber force and refrain from an arms race in outer space. The policy statement, the ninth since 1998, comes as Taiwan's president, Ma Ying-jeou, proposed the easing of tensions in the South China Sea, where China claims sovereignty over most of the contested waters and has engaged in land reclamation on disputed islands. Mr. Ma's South China Peace Initiative calls for setting aside sovereignty claims with a focus on negotiations and resource sharing. Bruce Jacobs, a Taiwan analyst at Australia's Monash University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty it's similar to Mr. Ma's 2012 proposal for the East China Sea, allowing Taiwan and Japan to jointly fish in contested waters.
The problem with the South China Sea is that the number of claimants are much greater. Another problem is Taiwan's claim to the South China Sea, which is based on very similar claims as China uses, and in fact, these are not historically correct. So Taiwan faces a difficulty there. One of the interesting things about the Taiwan claim is that, in fact, the main area that Taiwan occupies in the South China Sea now was originally occupied by the Japanese, and when the Japanese controlled Taiwan as a colony from 1895 to 1945, this area was actually administered through the Japanese colonial government in Taiwan through Kaohsiung. So one could argue, in fact, a better claim for Taiwan is not the Chinese claim to the so-called nine-dash line, but is actually that Taiwan is the successor to the Japanese colonial regime and that it should have control of the island for that reason.
Was its proposal in 2012 regarding the East China Sea well-received in Beijing?
Not particularly. I think it tended to be more ignored. But what was crucial was it was dealt with well by the Japanese, and the Japanese agreed to it. And as a result of that, a number of agreements were reached between Japan and Taiwan.
Why does Taiwan feel that it should put this forth? Why is it being the one that steps forward with this plan?
I think Taiwan feels diplomatically isolated, and this is a way to bring Taiwan forward into world affairs.
You probably know that the Philippine military and commercial aircraft are going to, according to President Benigno Aquino, keep flying over disputed areas in the South China Sea. Is that provocative?
No, I don't believe it's provocative. What I believe is provocative is that China is occupying and building construction on various reefs in areas that are extraordinarily far from China. They're over 1,000 miles or 1,600 kilometers away from China and in areas which are very close to the other claimants. One of the areas that both the Philippines and China claim is actually very close to the Philippines, but it's very far from China. But China says it belongs to it. The Chinese claims are primarily based on what they call historical claims. But I've had a look at these claims, and in fact, they're not true historical claims. For example, if something was written in a Chinese book many years ago about the South China Sea saying it's shallow and it has magnetic rocks, that's a description. That's not a claim. There's no evidence that China has any precedence in any of these areas historically.
Will anyone be able to stop the momentum that China seems to be building?
Both the United States and other countries will continue to express displeasure and will push on this.
Do they have any diplomatic leverage with China?
Diplomatic leverage isn't only one way, and for example, on trade issues. I mean, China has a strong surplus trade with many countries, but that doesn't mean that China is also not dependent on these trades. So, for example, China buys a lot of resources from Australia and from Brazil, but this gives Brazil and Australia a certain amount of clout as well. It's not all one way by any means.
In a related story, negotiators from Taiwan and China, as you know, met Saturday for talks in an attempt to maintain a momentum for the forging of closer ties. But this comes in the face of a rather skeptical Taiwanese public.
Basically, the Chinese say that Taiwan belongs to it. And again, there's no historical basis for this claim. I think it's important to emphasize that Taiwan is a middle-sized country. Its population is the same as Australia. It's economically advanced. It's also a democracy, and this democracy was hard won, and people in Taiwan are not ready to give this democracy away. And I think it's also important to note that Taiwan was never ruled by a mainland Chinese regime in its history, except for 4 years during the Civil War from 1945 to 1949. During the Manchu Dynasty, China itself was a colony of the Manchu Empire, and it certainly was not a Chinese regime that was ruling in Beijing. So I think that's an important point to make. This gets obscured when people look quickly at history.
Bruce Jacobs of Monash University. The heads of the two government offices in charge of cross-strait affairs have now met four times since their first session in early 2014. President Ma, who's in the final year of his second four-year term, has overseen the signing of several pacts aimed at building economic ties in sectors ranging from finance to tourism. China regards Taiwan as a renegade province and has not ruled out the use of force to take it back, particularly if the island makes a move towards independence. Well, joining me here in the studio is Web Desk editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending today. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, we were talking about last week, Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India. He got in some trouble on social media for some comments he made. Now he's taking a different approach on social media and trying to use it to his advantage. He sent out millions of direct messages to his followers with a hashtag Sal Ik Sharat Anik. And this is to celebrate his first year in office. These direct messages tailored to each person that they were sent to had their name and had 20 different infographics showing how India is better after his first year. People are saying this is kind of an unprecedented use of social media, directly messaging his millions of followers. And the use of this hashtag now, people are praising him and praising his government, but we're starting to see also some people using that hashtag to talk about things that are wrong in India after the first year. So more to follow on that to see if this is a successful strategy for him. We're also seeing in the U.S. trending Charter Communications. This is a cable company in the U.S. Announcing that it's going to bid to buy Time Warner for $55 billion. This would make it the number two cable company in the U.S., and as many people in the U.S. here love to complain about their cable service.
Absolutely.
When channels go out and things. So there's a lot of complaints already about what that's going to do to service here in the U.S. And on a bit of a more positive note, today is the 64th, or would have been the 64th birthday of astronaut Sally Ride. She's the first American woman in space. And Google, as they often do to honor different occasions, they've created a series of Google Doodles, what they call them, to honor Sally Ride. So you can visit on google.com on the homepage of the search engine. There are some images and some little pictorial graphics that show Sally Ride's life and tell a little bit about her and honor her.
Yeah, and I know she very much wanted to encourage girls to young women to be interested in science and in space.
Absolutely, and hopefully this will do that for Google today and raise some publicity.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's Web Desk editor Andrew Palshevsky.
This is Science in a Minute. I am Rick Pantaleo. A new neuroprosthetic device developed by an alliance of California scientists has made it possible for a quadriplegic man to operate a robotic arm with just his thoughts and imagination. Eric Sorto, who lost use of his limbs about 13 years ago, is the first person in the world to have a neural prosthetic device implanted on the posterior parietal cortex, or PPC, which is the area of the brain where intentions are made. Most other similar devices being used today are usually implanted in the motor cortex. That's the part of the brain that directly controls movement. But since this newly developed device was implanted in an area of the brain that controls the intent to move, the researchers were able to develop a way to operate the robotic arm with a much more natural, smooth, and fluid motion. And that's your Science in a Minute.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Malaysian authorities have denied entry to Hong Kong student activist Joshua Wong, one of the main organizers of last year's pro-democracy protests that riled Beijing. Wong posted on his Facebook page Tuesday that a Malaysian immigration official denied him entry because of a government order. The 18-year-old activist did not elaborate. Malaysian customs officials have not commented on the incident, which is reported to have happened on the northern Malaysian island of Penang. Wong was scheduled to speak at a series of seminars on the grassroots democracy movement in China and Beijing's 1989 crackdown on protesters at Tiananmen Square. And a fire that swept through a rest home in central China killed 38 people and injured six. That's according to Chinese authorities on Tuesday. The fire broke out Monday night in an apartment building being used as a privately run rest home in the city of Pingdongxing in Henan province. Two of the injured were in serious condition, the statement said. The official Xinhua News Agency reported that a rescue operation was still underway Tuesday morning and the cause of the fire was unclear. With a rapidly aging population and under-resourced social security net, China faces increasing pressure to provide safe and affordable care for the elderly. In 2013, a disgruntled resident set fire to a rest home, killing himself and 10 others in the northeastern province of Heilongjiang. Please look at our website for these and more stories. You can access it at voanews.com. We have a range of stories that might interest you, both features and news. These are the news headlines from VOA. This is International Edition on VOA. Coming up, a non-governmental agency deals with a crisis in Nepal following the recent earthquake there. Well, June 4th will mark the anniversary of the 1989 crackdown in Tiananmen Square. And as in years past, Hong Kong residents will mark the date with massive rallies throughout the city. Some say the event will be more meaningful this year as the Chinese government's political influence is increasingly felt. Shannon Van Sant reports from Hong Kong.
While mention of the 1989 massacre in Tiananmen Square is banned in mainland China, every year thousands of people gather in Hong Kong's Victoria Park to commemorate the anniversary. It is a time for people in Hong Kong to remember the atrocities of that day and express gratitude for their freedoms under China's one country, two systems principle. This year's anniversary comes just months after pro-democracy demonstrations filled Hong Kong streets, and tensions continue over China's political influence in the city. Richard Choi, deputy chairman of the Hong Kong Alliance in Support of Patriotic Democratic Movements, says a museum showcasing the history of the 89 crackdown has come under increasing pressure by authorities and the owners of the building that houses the museum.
And also, the owners in corporation, because they do the stadium management, they try to make various regulations in the recent months, try to restrict the visitors to come to our museum to witness the our exhibition. They ask all visitors to register at the entrance of the building and reveal all their identity information, like their identity card number, names, etc.
The June 4th Memorial Hall Museum opened in April of last year and is a permanent exhibit devoted to the 1989 crackdown. Choi says asking for identification will scare away visitors from the mainland. Recently, Hong Kong's Buildings Assessment Association also issued an order saying the museum violated building regulations. Choi says the museum completed the recommended building improvements in March and is waiting for government officials to re-examine the site. William Nee of Amnesty International says growing media censorship in Hong Kong is another sign of mainland China's influence in the former British colony.
It's amazing to see how much journalists feel that they're under pressure and how much they feel that they are having to self-censor, and the editors are coming under pressure. And I think that we saw that, you know, there were many allegations that Tiananmen has not been getting as much coverage as it was in the past, and the newspapers are not putting it as news stories about Tiananmen as prominently as they would have been.
According to the Paris-based organization Reporters Without Borders, in 2002, Hong Kong ranked 18th for press freedom globally. By 2014, Hong Kong had fallen to 61st place. Recently, some Hong Kong reporters have come under physical attack. Last year, two assailants slashed Mingpao newspaper editor-in-chief Kevin Lau with meat cleavers. Journalists say self-censorship is growing, and editors are given politically sensitive stories less prominence in Hong Kong's newspapers. Shirley Yam, a newspaper columnist and vice chairperson of the Hong Kong Journalists Association, described how Beijing exerts pressure on Hong Kong's reporters.
Well, some editors will have meetings with Beijing officials, lunch or dinner, and then you get signaled on the kind of things that they're really concerned with. And then you're supposed to do your own interpretations, and you draw the line.
As of 2014, more than half of Hong Kong local media owners sit on Beijing-appointed government bodies, such as the National People's Congress. Preparations are already underway for next month's candlelight vigil in Hong Kong on June 4th. More than 100,000 people are expected to attend. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Two major earthquakes have struck Nepal since April 25th, killing and wounding thousands and leaving untold numbers of Nepalese homeless. Relatively little is known about humanitarian groups assess the trauma and decide how and whom to help with funding and supplies. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with two representatives from American Jewish World Service, or AJWS, who were on the ground in rural Nepal and asked them to explain their mission strategy and personal approach.
Despite its name, American Jewish World Service is not a religious organization. Rather, it expresses the Jewish values of compassion and justice to help non-Jews who are suffering around the world. Whether in Haiti in 2010, when a hurricane killed more than 100,000 people, or the Philippines, where Typhoon Haiyan claimed over 6,300 lives in 2013, or in West Africa during last year's Ebola epidemic. Samantha Walthus, AJWS's Director of Disaster Response, spoke with VOA earlier this month within Nepal's earthquake zone.
We learn over and over and over again that people who are affected by these disasters know best what they need and how they want to be helped. So what we try to do at AJWS is earn the respect of the communities. We go in, we sit with people, we talk to them, we listen to them, we hear their stories, we cry with them, we laugh with them, and then we get to the support part.
Knowing the cultural nuances of a place is key to fulfilling AJWS's mission. That's one reason why Walthus relies on Aaron Acharya as her cultural guide and translator in the Nepali villages on her itinerary. Acharya was born in Bhutan and spent some years as a political refugee in Nepal. Today, he lives in New York, where he helps administer AJWS's global projects.
These are the people who give me refuge when I didn't have a home. And if I can support them in any way, interpreting for them so that other people can actually hear not only the words that they're saying, but also are hearing the emotions and the challenges and the culture and the traditions that come with the word, I'm giving something back.
AJWS's niche among NGOs is to attend to a society's most vulnerable and underserved populations. For example, TEWA, also called the Nepal Women's Fund, is a Kathmandu-based grassroots group dedicated to women's rights and maternal health. Walthus says that post-quake, TEWA has been sheltering pregnant mothers in tents and giving them food, blankets, medical care, and bottled water.
We've heard multiple stories about women that have had babies in these fields under these tents. And with HAWS's funds, they're also working to raise awareness in the camps about the risk of waterborne diseases and health epidemics that may arise and that we're helping to prevent before the monsoon really gets heavy here.
HAWS also funds Nepal's Blue Diamond Society, which works with Nepal's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community.
They're doing a lot of work with the HIV positive community. You know, we've seen over and over again in disasters that it's very hard for individuals that have HIV or even AIDS who are reliant on the medicine to get that care after a disaster because, you know, all of the medical providers are focused on caring for folks that have been injured in the disaster. We saw this as well with Ebola in Liberia.
The Dalits of Nepal, who occupy the lowest rung in the country's ancient caste system, can also get left behind by government and government-apportioned NGO funding. So AJWS funds a Dalit-run group who is far more familiar with the community's challenges, which include discrimination, than either foreign NGOs or non-Dalit Nepalis.
We don't go in as AJWS and say we think we understand the dynamics and we want everyone to get along. That's not our role. We actually hire local people on the ground to be here to help them fill out the proposals, write the reports, and learn about their challenges and their successes. So it really is a collaborative effort.
Aaron Acharya says sometimes there's tension and rivalry between tribal and ethnic villages as they compete for foreign aid and relief.
So if you can bring like tents to this one village and you don't bring it to the other, it would probably translate as you are favoring this tribe over the other. So as a funder, being aware of those kind of tensions, those kind of nuances in a community, I think is very, very important.
One conflict avoidance strategy is to recruit a native Nepali who is not openly affiliated with AJWS or another NGO to come to a community alone on a motorbike and unobtrusively gather information.
And they try to figure out what's going on here, what's needed, who lives here, who are the leaders, what are the different tribes or ethnic groups that this village is made up. They try to collect all of that data without creating any kind of tension in the communities.
That's just one of the many balancing acts NGOs must perform while in country, in locales where suffering is great and the future is unsure. Samantha Walthus says American Jewish World Service strives to do the greatest good for the most people, efficiently, respectfully, and for the very long term. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
If you'd like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is a Pacific nation, and as such has an enormous stake in the people and future of Southeast Asia. The region is home to some of our largest trading partners and buys many of our exports, supporting millions of American jobs. We need partnerships with the Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, Singapore, and Vietnam, and other nations there to meet the challenges of growing our economy, preventing nuclear proliferation, and addressing climate change. The U.S. works constantly to strengthen old alliances there and deepen new ones. Toward that end, top U.S. officials met recently with their counterparts in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, in the 28th in a series of annual dialogues aimed at reinforcing our strategic partnership with the region. Both parties reaffirmed their commitment to jointly realize solutions to pressing global, regional, and transnational issues of...
Let me love you. So bad, bad, bad.